Thank you so much for that kind introduction. And while this is loading, there we go. I appreciate the opportunity to speak here. We're one of the examples of putting this public health model to work. So we're going to try. I'm going to try to share with you some of the lessons we've learned from doing this work around prevention over the last decade, as well as some of the very specific lessons that the Unity Project has taught us and that we've been able to apply to some of our work. I'd like to tell you just a little bit about who we are, and I share this as much because I feel like it represents the transition that a lot of organizations have made from this criminal justice model of violence prevention to one that focuses far more on public health. We like to say we sit at the center of public health and social justice. We began in 1980. Our boss, Esther Soler, got a small grant from during the Carter administration, actually back in the late 70s, to do something about domestic violence. And she sat in the jail. She was in the prosecutor's office. It literally was, the first office was an empty jail cell. And it was, you know, go fix this problem, and clearly this problem sits in the prosecutor's office. We've, you know, since transitioned this model, and I'll sort of walk you through that a little bit more. Just so you know, we house the National Health Resource Center on Domestic Violence, so we are going to talk somewhat about the health work. Recently, in Cleveland is also one of our models in this program. We provide technical assistance to the Attorney General's Defending Childhood Initiative. And I greatly appreciate this conversation, and I'll try to add to it as well about, you know, making the link between how violence prevention is a public health issue. But I will say having an advocate in the Attorney General is tremendously helpful. I mean, this is someone who has said very publicly, my legacy is not closing Guantanamo. My legacy is ending violence against children and helping children heal from violence and youth violence in particular. Also, I want to share that our organization recently this year went through the process of changing our name to Futures Without Violence to capture exactly this transition, to be honest, that we're talking about. And we also moved into the Presidio, into a national park, which is also, I think, deeply important and very symbolic for us, because it really was about how do we make these issues public issues, and how do we bring communities together to solve these issues in a public way. And we look at both domestic violence, child abuse, and youth violence prevention collectively, again, both in communities and homes, and globally. As I started to say, we began, as I said, about 30 years ago, focusing on domestic violence as a crime. We realized pretty quickly that the solutions we were offering women were not the solutions that they wanted, and they weren't the solutions that were going to actually solve the problem. Women don't necessarily want to go to shelter. Shelters, and I never want to demean shelters, shelters are life-saving places. Women and kids are alive today that would not be alive were it not for domestic violence shelters. That said, that's not where most families want to be. It's not where most women want to be. And often when you are there, you're there for short periods of time. The majority of people in domestic violence shelters are children. And they also often have very strict rules around accepting boys who are older than 11 or 12, which when we talk about family building, community building, and these issues around youth violence prevention also poses its own problems, because you have some of these kids who we know have already been exposed to a lot of violence, some frequently very traumatic, intensive violence, who are then not even allowed to be in the place of help. We also realized, you know, enforcement programs also impact, disproportionately harm marginalized and poor communities. And again, our place as a part of a broader social justice movement felt that, you know, we didn't want to be part of the solution, to be honest, of putting more low-income men of color in jail. And we understand that there needs to be accountability, and sometimes that involves law enforcement, but that wasn't going to end the problem of violence against women and children. And so we also realized that we needed to shift our focus to prevention and start a lot earlier. So I was happy to hear Howard Pinderhugh's name. So about maybe 10 years ago, we tried to pull together, and you know, we've tried to live in these fields of domestic violence, child abuse, and youth violence. And we realized, you know, one of the lessons learned is that we need to start bringing these communities together, because they do sit in silos in offices in cities and offices in state public health departments. And they need to come together, because in many cases the problems we're trying to solve are the same problem. And so we said, okay, how do we go about bringing these fields together? And what we did is we said, okay, let's go find the smartest people we know in these different fields. Howard Pinderhugh is one of them. And we asked them to commission papers. So we asked Deborah Darrow to look at some of the child abuse work. We looked, asked Howard to talk about youth violence, and we asked some of our colleagues in the domestic violence field, Jeff Edelson, around children exposed to violence, to write some papers for us and say, okay, if we were to do primary prevention for your field, what would that look like? You know, because everybody knows we're competing on resources. How do we focus to tackle all of these issues? Because we do find ourselves in this cycle of, you know, where does it start? Does it start with the child abuse? Does it start with the domestic violence? Does it start with the youth violence? And we know each contribute to each other. And from our perspective, we tend to waste a lot of time and energy, you know, arguing over sort of what's the original sin and, you know, what are some things we can do to focus on all of these things together. And so we commissioned these papers. We said, okay, what are some of the core strategies that if we were to do these three, four, five things that we could have measurable impacts on all of these? And again, talk about, you know, the public health model, putting some of our strategies to work. We said, you need to deal with the fact that there are kids that are being hurt now. And so we need to help those kids heal. And so we said we need to focus on services for kids who are already exposed to violence, either violence that they're witnessing or experiencing, because we know each have impacts. We know that young families are a real point of impact, right, where we can help focus on, you know, youth who themselves and young adults who may very well have been exposed to violence themselves. But we know that the birth of a child presents a new opportunity, and to be honest, is a real motivating strategy for many people who have already been exposed to violence. Like, I want it to stop with me. This is my chance to fix this. And so we know that this is a primary time for intervention. So we supported programs like home visitation, for instance, which is how do we get some intensive services to these new and young families. And then what we realized, we talk about the more, going back to more prevention models, we need to get the men involved. And we need to change some of the models for younger men and boys, because the men who are hurting, you know, we come from a sort of a domestic violence field, so these men who are perpetrating domestic violence are also men who are hurting other boys and men, right? We still know that the majority of people, even though I come from a women's organization, who are being killed by violence are other men and boys. So we need to change those norms that hurt men and women and children and families together. I will say, we did not focus on this then, and one of the other real strategies, and I'm going to talk about that today, and a lot of the brain research has really driven us in this direction, and a lot of, I think, some of the lessons we've learned from the youth violence work, which is when you talk to youth, start younger. I mean, they're the first ones to tell you, you know, start younger if you can. So we started to really focus on this middle school age, this sort of preteen 11 to 14-year-old. The brain folks are telling us a lot of the social-emotional development learning, a lot of the relationship stuff is being formed there, right? There's this time 0 to 5 in a kid's development that's really important, and they're telling us that this other middle school time is, if your goal is youth violence prevention, right, you know, if you can start younger, that's a great thing. And so we've started doing a lot more of that work. So I want to talk about two ways that we have tried to put some of these strategies to work. One is this, what we call the Start Strong, Building Healthy Teen Relationships Initiative. And I want to talk for a moment because I really appreciate, it's not a program, it's a series of strategies, right? And everybody gets locked in. And I'll be honest, we have felt the need to create programs because that's what folks, you know, to the funder question. And I'll be honest, and I'll throw this out, I'll take advantage of this room for a moment. It's also, to be honest, the pressure we get from evaluators, right? And so I would love to, at the point at which there's a time for conversation, and I know that we have many of the nations and world leading public health experts, that the challenge of how do we measure effectiveness when we're not measuring the same thing, right? So exactly to the point that Howard brought up, which is, if the most successful program is to go in and probably listen to people, help them assess, get the right people to the table, and help them figure out what's going to work in their community, that can be really hard to evaluate. I mean, you can look sort of long-term change, but again, I'll say that we've often felt pressure from evaluators to take a lot of that creativity and that individuality of programs and narrow it down to one thing so we can measure those things. So I welcome that conversation. I also think it's important symbolically that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a healthcare foundation, said violence prevention is our issue. We can't do obesity, we can't do all the health things that we care about if we don't tackle violence. And I think that is, you know, an example of the progress we really have made over the years. So we focus on this particular initiative focuses on 11 communities anchored around middle school. And again, you're going to notice these four things, the four core components. Which is about educating and engaging youth in and out of school. I think one of the things we really liked about middle school is most kids are still in school at that stage. And often some of our most vulnerable kids are out of school by the time they're 16, 17. So we have a place where we can do some intensive work, right? We need to hit in multiple places. We need to talk to the individuals. We need to talk to who influences them in their community. You know, the circles, we need to keep moving out to the greater community and their environment. So we focus on the youth themselves. And I don't have time to go into it today, but for those of you who work with youth directly, I feel like, and particularly these middle school youth, because I do want to say 16 and 12 and 13 are different worlds, you know. Those are not, you know, and we tend to like youth and lump those ages together, and they're really not. Yet, those 16 and 17-year-olds are probably the biggest influence you can have on those 11, 12, and 13-year-olds. So we really learned, I talk about the near peers, that schools still matter and are a real place to do some of this work. Parents still really matter, and a lot of the effort is convincing parents that they still matter, because a lot of them feel like they don't. So we've done a lot of work around that. Getting the older youth involved, and then obviously changing the environmental policy factor, so, you know, trying to get school policies in place, for instance, or trying to get laws that fund prevention programs in place. And how do you get the youth engaged? And I will say the thing that I have been not directly involved in the programmatic work, but that the time and energy, and I think to really identify strategies for working with youth to find solutions that work for them, not talking at them, with adult solutions, and again, that older youth and younger youth are very different kids, is important, and that there's some really good strategies for how to do that, so I'll share that website if folks are interested in that, because I think we learned quite a bit, again, strategies for getting parents. Yeah, I think we often struggle how to get the parents to the meetings, particularly in these communities where there's a whole lot else going on, and it's hard to get there, and it's a two-hour bus ride, et cetera. Okay, so I wanted to just show some examples of some of the things that the youth themselves came up with, which is, you know, we know media are really important to young people and a great way to reach young people. So we had some of these different sites came up with kind of what's going to work in our, you know, with kids I know to get them to think about these issues. And I think the other big challenge around this was specifically around a dating violence prevention effort is how do you do prevention with kids who don't date, right? So anything that's going to talk about dating violence prevention, but I don't date, this doesn't apply to me. Most parents think their 12 and 13-year-old does not date, so it doesn't apply to them either. And what we know, right, is that the kids aren't going to define it in that language. The parents don't think it's happening, but it is happening, and it's happening with consequences. So how do we focus prevention activities to kids who don't think they're a part of the group that needs it? And so we said, okay, let's look at media. And what is it teaching you about relationships? Because the one thing young people are really into is their relationships. Those matter. I mean, developmentally, everything, anybody who's a parent knows, relationships matter to young people. You have kids that work with the Homeless Youth Project, and they are online. They don't have a home. They don't have parents. They are finding ways to get online to connect, right? So we said, okay, they're consuming media. They're great media consumers. So we tried to have the kids themselves develop some of their campaigns. So one of our sites did, you know, the Is It Real? And, you know, rated R. And how do we analyze media? And so it's helping kids analyze media for what are the images, impressions it's creating. I don't know if folks know that the series, Bella, the Twilight series of books that were enormously popular among young people. And so what one of our sites did is they said, you know, this is actually an example of a really bad relationship, really bad abusive relationships that are the most popular media thing among this certain age group. So what they did is they went to the opening of one of the movies, so kids were lined up for hours, and they had them fill out a short survey. And it's the campaign for the third choice, which is isn't there a way, you know, that the core sort of theme of a lot of around that movie was she had to choose. And they're saying, you know, she had to choose between two really bad options, and that's not what we want. We want her to have a different option. And so, and again, it was something that the kids came up with entirely, their idea of we're going to go, you know, knowing that kids are going to be waiting in line for hours to try to get tickets to the movie. They had a captured audience. And it was a great idea. And then they go get media, right? So then, you know, we realized these three-question surveys, doing surveys are a great advocacy tool and a great way to get youth involved themselves. So even though from a social science standpoint, it's not necessarily a, you know, perfect randomized control trial, it's a great way to get media attention. It's a great way to involve the youth themselves. And it's a great way that the youth can then talk to other youth, which is one of the things that they talked to us about. Los Angeles, one of our examples was to do policy work. You know, as is often the case around this work, it's sadly some of our successes often happen over the tragic death of a young person. But I think what we also know is that if we haven't been doing the work for the 10 years, that even those tragic cases, you know, we don't get the outcomes from policy or programmatic levels, right? And so for Peace Over Violence is an organization that has a very primary prevention public health focused organization working on, you know, again, multiple forms of child abuse, youth violence, and domestic violence. They've been working in the community for years. And one of the goals of the Start Strong initiative was to get every school to have a policy. And so the Los Angeles Unified School District was one of them. And so years of work in terms of gathering information about the rates of violence, how violence, to your point, about how violence impacts learning. I mean, one of the things that we know is that violence impacts all these other things. And so getting the schools involved to say, your kids, you know, when they're 3, 5, 6, they're not ready to learn. They're not showing up to school ready to learn when they're in homes and communities with a lot of violence. They're far more likely to drop out when they're older, if you're not dealing with the violence. So it has a great impact on a lot of their goals, and obviously it's about getting them to understand that whoever you work with, it's about how can we, if you take on our work that we're asking you to do, and it's more work, there's no question about it, we're asking you to go to more meetings, we're asking you to give up more staff time. But what we're saying is we can help you get your outcomes, right? So you have some outcomes about kids' readiness to learn, kids' grades, kids staying in school. And so because of the work that had gone in terms of organizing the community, identifying who the players were, the Los Angeles school within the last 2 months passed a policy that all schools will get teen dating violence prevention in the LA Unified Schools. I also want to talk about another one of the strategies we talked about, and again, this is sort of a how do we put the model to work, and this is a program we called Coaching Boys into Men. Again, it became a program. It was always strategies. we really do about sort of how do you engage men in this work, which is sort of always how we had it listed, and then we needed to put it in a box for people. So, you know, on the one hand, I want to welcome that suggestion because I think it's right. On the other hand, sometimes in terms of branding something, you need to find a frame with which to bring in all the people and all the players. So what do we know? Who influences boys, right? And how can we influence the influencers is what this program was largely about. So it's about reaching the boys individually who play sports. And we would love to start a coaching girls, and so we're trying to make that happen. So I don't want to say it's just boys, but we know if we can influence boys, that's a good thing. Our real target audience are the coaches. And coaches, as anybody who's played sports or has been a coach knows, coaches are about a lot more than sports. and the good coaches know that they're there to, you know, you talk about connecting a kid to a trusted adult, right? So that's one of the things that we know. You know, kids and young people, and particularly kids who come from more violent communities, often lack that caring, stable adult to connect with. And coaches can be that person for some kids, boys and girls. So we want to work with the coaches to help influence the youth. And then we want it to change sort of norms and behavior. So it's both the individual and then the community. And then we do some, you know, there's also public service advertising as well to address community norms. I think there's other presentations on the actual study and the intervention, but I do want to say that we do believe deeply that you need to evaluate programs. I mean, that's, I think, one of the other points, which is that we can't be afraid to evaluate ourselves. And I know I often struggle because you meet a lot of folks in communities who are like, I know I reached kids with this program. And I'm like, I know you did too. But when I've got to go to a policymaker, which is sort of my job, and say, you have $5 million. Are you going to spend it here or are you going to spend it here? You know, we need to make those hard choices. So we all need to be open to that. And we need to add cost effectiveness is my sort of other recommendation, that when we do evaluation, how much does it cost to do the program is really helpful in terms of making the case for the program. So, again, these are all going to look very similar to the strategies that you've already heard presented. Raising awareness, you know, changing norms and attitudes. We're going to measure that. You know, here's our model of sort of what we think will happen. When we do this work, there's going to be increased awareness. There's going to be increased gender equitable attitudes and intention to intervene. Now, no, we don't have measures of, you know, the hardcore measures. But I'll be honest to this point about the cycles. We don't think in a one-year intervention that you're going to, you know, that I can prove to you that the dating violence has been reduced or youth violence has been reduced in 1 to 2 years. And so that is also often the case I will make, which is that we need 5 and 10 years to demonstrate results. And so we're not going to get that in funding cycles, so that we need to have the markers along the way. And so these were the best markers that we could come up with along the way. I will say, so we're in Sacramento. We had a 3-year evaluation. We had 16 high schools. And we have the data is back. It's not yet published, so I had to actually check with our evaluator, Liz Miller, formerly from the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston. So is doing our evaluation. And, you know, I will say, to the point that violence prevention, we know there are things that can work. And I think it's deeply, deeply important that we, as advocates and as practitioners and as researchers, toot our own horns a bit. I mean, I think that the challenge of research in these settings and the challenge of researchers is that you often begin with what I don't know. Like, the tendency is always, I don't want to say anything too big because my data doesn't necessarily say that. It says for these kids in this situation, in this community, on this date, this kind of worked. And so what I'm saying is, I want us to all be advocates, which is like, no, there are some things that really work, and there are some things that don't work. And we don't have to know everything before we can tout what we do know. And that's why I'm so proud and we're thrilled with the Unity Project for doing that. So we got some great results with the program. You know, I'm not going to say it's like this program alone. We will be the first ones to tell you, a program with coaches alone is not going to end youth violence, is not going to end dating violence. But when you add it to this menu of other things, we think it can be effective and is worth investing in, right? So I'm going to stop there. It's already taken up some of your time, and I'm happy to answer more questions about the programs or the studies or other ideas. Thanks.